Welcome to episode 233 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today is a special episode in which I'm lucky enough to speak with Mark Smith, the train travel expert, also known as the man from Seat 61. Now, I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with Mark. He is so knowledgeable about train travel, and in this interview, we discuss his background and how he came to set up his website, seat61.com. This being the Ski Podcast, I quizzed Mark for his views on the best routes to the Alps by train, the trend towards night trains, plus you can find out if he thinks there will ever be competition for Eurostar on the cross-channel line. Now, before we move on to our interview, if you are heading to the Alps this winter by train or not, can I remind you that you can save money on your ski hire by using the code SKIPODCAST at insportrent.com. Or simply take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied at the checkout. If you want to help the Ski Podcast, this is a simple way to do it, and it will save you money too. Right, let's listen to my conversation with Mark Smith, the man from Seat 61.
Even if you're not an aficionado of train travel, there's a good chance you will have heard of my guest today, Mark Smith, who is also known as the man from Seat 61. Hi, Mark, how are you?
Hello, very well, thank you.
Whereabouts are you today?
Well, I'm back home. I've just got in off the sleeper from Scotland. I did a quick trip up to Fort William and Malick on my favourite train, the London Fort William Deerstalker. That's what they call it. Great trip.
Excellent. Is that the Caledonian sleeper, right?
That's right. It's the Caledonian sleeper. They've got a portion to Inverness, a portion to Aberdeen, and the best bit is the portion to Fort William, which takes you up the wonderful West Island line.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, we will refer to that again a little bit later. It's a train I've been on, although not the whole way. So next time I have to extend that a little bit. But, listener, if you don't know the website, seat61.com, it's a multiple award-winning website with more than 1 million visitors per month. Now, when I was doing my research, that could have been from years ago. So it may be more than that, but it's all about rail travel. And to be specific, and I think I'm right in saying this, the aim is to inspire people and enable people to travel by train by showing them what's possible and how to do it. I'm going to come onto the site and how it can help not just skiers, but anyone who wants to travel by train. But first, I have to ask you, Mark, it's a very unusual name. Why is it called Seat 61?
Well, you know, when I was going somewhere special, like London to Nagasaki via Brussels, Moscow and Vladivostok, or London to Marrakesh via Paris and Madrid and Algeciras, I would kick off by treating myself to first class on Eurostar. And nobody likes sitting next to a pillar, do they? Or next to the window with the emergency exit bar halfway across it, which is right at my eye level. So I looked at the best seats, and the best seat was coach was 7, 8, 11 or 12, seat 61. So that became a sort of tradition. So when the website started, the name was already there.
Okay, so now I understand that. Just out of interest then, if you were not in first class and you were in regular, would seat 61 still be a good one to go for within the carriage?
Oh, well, there are lots of seats that line up with the windows in standard class and that fit the bill. Depends on your preferences, really. But in first class, you want one of the solo seats that you aisle on one side, window on the other. And I happen to like a table for two where you're not staring at a seat back 6 inches from your face.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I go on Eurostar quite a few times a year, and I have got one first class one coming up in about a month's time. So I might revisit my reservation there and have a look at that. I'm interested in how the site came about. In my research, I read that you worked in the rail industry for many years before you founded the website itself. But what prompted you to start the site?
Well, I ended up commuting to London to a job in the Department for Transport, head of the fares and ticketing team. In their rail division. And the day finally arrived where I finished my novel. Not the novel I was writing, the novel I was reading on the train home. So I popped into W.H. Smith's at Marylebone Station to look for something to read on the train home, keep me occupied. It's an hour back to my house on the train. And I bought a book, more of a magazine, really, £2.95. That's all it cost me. Probably the best £2.95 I ever spent. It was a teacher self-book about HTML, about getting a web page online. And I followed the instructions because in those days you got an email address from Virgin Net or whoever it was, and they gave you 2 meg of web space. And it worked, and I got a web page online. And I thought I'd do something about the massive gap between how easy I've always found it to take the train down to Italy or Spain or the Alps, and how impossible it had become to find anyone in the commercial world who would tell you how to do it. I thought I'd put that information online.
That's brilliant. And actually, it really resonates with me as well, because I set up a business at a similar time, which is called Natives, which was a community for season workers, for people who've been doing ski seasons, because I felt there was a lack of information about what it was really like and how you could find out jobs, etc. Similar era, that was in 1999. I think Seat 61 started in 2001. And like yourself, it wasn't a magazine, but I went down to the library and got myself a book to teach yourself Dreamweaver, I think was a particular piece of software that I used at the time. And I guess both of those two sites, you know, had a big, what they call first mover advantage. I presume there were no other sites offering this information anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, there still aren't, at least not in the same sort of way. But it's definitely true. If you got in at the early stages of the web, if Google knows you've been there for 20 years, that does give you a better position than somebody starting up now. That's true.
Yeah, for sure. And so initially, again, there is a parallel here because, you know, I started that. I was doing it, I guess, primarily as a hobby, and I had another job as well. And at some point I had to make that decision where I actually said to my boss, look, could I cut down to part time? And he said no. So I ended up leaving that job and doing it full time. And I guess the same sort of situation happened to you. At some point you decided to go full time on the website instead of doing your regular job.
Well, that's right. It was 2007 that I gave up the day job to do the website full time. It has become such a monster to update, even before you add the actual traveling to get the information, that it's just as well that's become possible. The first thing I did actually was go down to 4 days a week. They let me do that. And that's a huge step forward, because although it's only 1 day a week that you're not there, going from 5 days on, 2 days off, to 4 days on, 3 days off, that's quite a big change in ratio, and it's a great change in lifestyle, even if that's all you do.
For sure. I also read that one of the motivators for making that change, a bit like for me with the podcast, is that you consider it to be more fun than real work.
It is. I mean, the annual timetable update, when all the European timetables change in December every year, that's 5 weeks of slog. That almost feels like work, but the other 47 weeks, the website does its thing, and it's me doing my hobby, helping people doing your hobby. What's that old Chinese proverb? Give a man a job he loves and he'll never work another day in his life. That's absolutely true.
That is beautiful. I love that quote and that summary. But I guess as well as wanting to help people find that information, you obviously have a passion for travel by train. And, you know, a key motivator for me, I mean, we'll come on to all the different reasons why train travel is great, but it has a much lower carbon footprint than flying, for example. And you're kind of preaching to the converted in discussion with me. I took the Flight Free pledge last year through Anna Hughes's Flight Free UK. I took no flights. I'll be planning to do the same thing for 2025. But I wonder what you would say to any listeners who've been thinking about train travel, but, you know, aren't really sure about it. You know, what would you say are the main reasons for traveling by train?
Well, I didn't get into train travel because I wanted to save the planet and thought I better suffer to do that, because it's worth suffering to save the planet. You're not suffering at all. You're doing yourself a favour. I got into train travel because it's a nicer way of travelling. People are getting fed up of the airport and airline experience. And the journey, to my way of thinking, should be part of the experience. It should be as fun as the holiday. The holiday starts when you leave home, not when you finally get to the hotel at the other end. And train travel is, you're not seat belted in. You get to see where you're going. You can stand up and walk around. I was chatting over haggis, tatties and neeps with a glass of wine in the lounge car last night with people there. It was a great journey. And that's what it's all about, enjoying the journey. So it takes a bit more planning than flying. It's affordable. That's the important thing. It might not be the same as the cheapest possible flight. But again, remember, you don't need to pay baggage fees. You don't need to pay to get to and from the airport and all the rest of the extra charges that airlines lump on. So it's part of the holiday. That's what you've got to think of it as.
Sure. Well, I mean, as I said, you're kind of preaching to the converted, but it is interesting to me. All of those elements of traveling by train are so much better, like the check-in. You know, I'm constantly saying to people, you know, when I go to London St Pancras, I know they tell you to get there an hour beforehand, but typically, you know, I tend to cut it a little fine, but typically it only takes me about 15 minutes. It can be as little as 5 minutes to go all the way through. And then what you mentioned about baggage, the baggage fees, etc., the convenience. And people are often obsessed, I think, by how that it might take longer to travel by train, but they don't think about what they would be doing with that time
exactly.
Instead.
I was going to say, when I started this, I think there are people out there who think if you're going to Italy by train, well, that takes weeks, doesn't it? Of course it doesn't. You can leave London in the morning, be in Milan in the for dinner in the evening. It's actually much faster than people think. It appears to take longer than flying, but actually when you lump in all the extra check-in and getting to and from the airport, and you look at what you'd have done with the rest of the day anyway, there's not as much in it as you think. And it's just such a better experience. It's a better way of spending your day.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you there. I also read another quote from you when I was doing my research. It said, we're in danger of creating a world where every single journey is an identical non-experience at 30,000 feet. Life is too short not to grab every experience when you get the chance. And that really kind of resonated with me, that.
Absolutely. That's definitely the case. It's travel has been commoditized. That's the word. And if you take the train, well, there's no ISO 9000 there most of the time. Every experience is different. Every country is different. Every line and route and all the scenery is different. It's all about the experience.
Yeah, for sure. Well, this is a ski podcast. And one of the reasons I wanted to ask you on is to kind of lean into a lot of your knowledge of traveling by train within Europe, primarily. You know, the history, in terms of the history of the UK ski industry, it was founded on train travel. The original operators such as Ingham's and Erne Lowe, who've been taking people since the 1930s, 1940s, everyone went by train at that point. My parents first went skiing in the 1960s and were going by train. And you and I, Mark, just had a little conversation in the green room earlier about both traveling by train, I think in the 90s. So I wondered if we could start perhaps with talking about the Eurostar Snow Train. Many listeners will know this. You know, I've reported on it before. And I'll put a link into the show notes if you want to know more about that service. I don't think we'll go into that specifically. We know that it runs. What I'm interested in is evidently there were many more services several years ago, and Eurostar had a change in strategy. There's no longer a direct service from London to Bourg-Saint-Maurice in the French Alps. The current service takes you via Lille. You take a train to Lille and then you change onto a Thalys train there. Do you think they'll ever bring back that direct service again?
It is possible, yes. I mean, at the moment, there are changes afoot in passport control processing, basically because of Brexit. The EU are bringing in enhanced checks, what is effectively a visa, an ETIAS e-visa. Fingerprints need to be taken. This is for all people outside the EU. So that means us, unfortunately. So it's going to take longer to process people, which limits the capacity at St Pancras. And already we need to have our passport stamped. We didn't before. It only takes a few seconds. But when you're processing people, that means a 30% reduction in capacity already, even before these other things come in. So Eurostar is limiting the range of destinations. It's concentrating on its core destinations, Paris, Brussels, Amsterdam. But once these things come in, once they're bedded in, once Eurostar have found a way of automating them and they've made sure it works, and there is now a study that says that St Pancras can be rejigged, lose a few retail units, enlarge the departure lounge to process more people, even with these new checks, then they'll start to look, I hope, at restoring their further destinations, the ski train in winter, and they used to run a summer train down to Lyon and Avignon and Marseille in the summer as well, which is currently also stopped.
Well, that is hugely encouraging to hear that it might change. And I'm very mindful of the new, I think it's the EEAS system. I can't remember the exact acronym now, but the changes that are in place. I mean, theoretically, that was due to start at the back end of 2024. I think there's the date is unknown due to the implications of putting it in action in the UK, in Dover, Folkestone, and in St. Pancras as well. And, you know, previously reported on their plans for how they're going to make that work there. But that is very encouraging. What about the rotations? You know, there used to be a couple of trains. One would go out on a Friday overnight. One would go out on the Saturday in the day. You know, I'm aware that this is a train that goes out there, a train that comes back. Do you think that they might increase the number of rotations, let's say, prior to starting that, you know, hopeful direct service?
Basically, what they're doing at the moment is providing a Eurostar connection into what used to be the Thalys ski train from Amsterdam and Brussels. So it's the pre-existing Amsterdam-Brussels ski train with a connection from London. So I can't see them adding more services at this stage. I think they're going to want to get Etias and all the other EU entry arrangements sorted out and bedded in before they look at expanding.
Okay, that's interesting. This is, I only dropped this question in at the last minute. Someone asked about it via social media yesterday. And this is a question for you. I know that, you know, you have different kind of categories of travel on Eurostar, the standard and plus or premier. If you were doing that Eurostar snow train on that Thalys, now Eurostar train that goes down from Holland, Belgium and down to the Alps, are there graded first and second class seats available there as well?
Well, Eurostar and Eurostar, formerly Thalys, because of course Eurostar and Thalys merged and are now both called Eurostar, which can get confusing at times. They have now synchronized their class names. So they are Standard, Plus and Premier. The difference is that the Plus, the sort of first class for leisure travel, includes food and drink and some nice wines in Eurostar, formerly Eurostar. But on the Eurostar, formerly Thalys routes, Plus gives you a first class seat, but no food and drink. Premier still does, both types of Eurostar. So yes, if you want food and drink on both the both stages of that journey down to the Alps, you'll need to go for the Premier.
Okay. Well, that answers that specific question. You mentioned about the amount of space that's available in St. Pancras, and yeah, that is a key issue. One of the reasons why I think Eurostar have said that they're running on a reduced capacity at the moment. I'm particularly interested in whether you think we'll ever see competitors on that route. Because if you want to travel by train from Europe, you have to take the Eurostar, or you only start when you get to Calais or Folkestone or Dieppe or something like that. Will we ever see competitors on that line?
It's possible. Now, I'm not holding my breath, because starting up a new train service doesn't take days or weeks or months. You're talking at least 5 years before anyone can go from a standing start to running a train service, possibly longer. But it's a lucrative route. It's a very, very popular route. We have HS1 and Eurotunnel both actively trying to promote extra users of their infrastructure. And we have people interested, Evelyn, Virgin, and at least one other, I think, that's interested in competing with Eurostar. Before that happens, they need to sort out the capacity for processing passengers at St. Pancras. And the report which came out a couple of weeks ago, I think, that said, yes, it can be done. We can double the number of passengers that can be processed at St. Pancras, was very encouraging. That was a study commissioned by HS1, who are the people who operate the high-speed line between St. Pancras and the Channel Tunnel, and they operate St. Pancras station itself.
Yeah, and here's another question that I don't know the answer to that would be really interesting. When I've been talking to people about potential competitors, you said HS1 operate St. Pancras. So they're the people who own the station, own the check-in, own that whole area. So it would be up to them. Is it limited to that particular site at the moment? Or could you board people for HS1 in another location?
You could, but the international trains need baggage screening and secure stabling for the rolling stock. They need secure stations where you can ensure that the security of people travelling in and out of the country. So that limits your options. And you don't necessarily want all the costs of setting up a new location. And you want a location in central London. So St Pancras is the obvious one because it's there and it's set up to do that. But it does need its capacity increasing.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Well, let's talk a bit more specifically then about ways of travelling to the Alps. A lot of people have gone on the Eurostar snow train. Typically, people would take a Eurostar to Paris and then go on. And to France and Switzerland, that's relatively straightforward. Typically, you'd go to Gare de Lyon and then take a train on from there. What about Italy? I'm interested in this. The Italian Alps, there's been a fantastic service that has gone from Paris to and Turin beyond. That has been limited, I'm going to say, for 2 years now, possibly, due to a landslide in the Maurienne Valley. And I believe it still hasn't opened yet. Like, there is a service, but it's a bus replacement service to go over the pass. Is that the current
situation? That's right, that's right. 27th of August 2023, half the mountainside collapsed onto the road and railway crossing the Alps directly from Paris into Italy. And it's been blocked ever since. They've been trying to, it's not just a question of clearing it and rebuilding the line, it's a question of shoring up the mountainside to make sure more doesn't come down. The good news is that the data shows trains resuming from the 31st of March. Now, there's been no official announcement. Booking isn't open yet. So I consider that intel rather than confirmation, but it's looking like March or the end of March will be the date for resumption of train service. And there's two train services from Paris to that part of Italy and on to Turin and Milan. There are the original French TGVs and there are the competing Italian Frecciarossas. Both trains are good. They're competing, which means you get a good deal on price. They're both bookable through sites such as RailEurope.com and TheTrainLine.com. And I don't think you'll be disappointed whichever one you take once they resume.
Yeah, I mean, that would be really good because I don't know what the French translation for bus replacement service is, but it's probably three of the most feared words in the English language. I'm sure it is in France as well. And that would really help. And that is a super quick line. I mean, I've been down to Modane before on the TGV from Paris. And you know, it's really quick out to that spot. You can get into the Alps, you know, very quickly and then on to Turin. I'm interested in the Dolomites as well. We will come to the new European sleeper service a little bit later on. But if someone was interested in skiing in the Dolomites or maybe some of the areas of the Alps that you would access, let's say the Otto Valley or Alagna, Piedmonte area, something like that. How would you say that tunnel was open? How would you recommend they access that and or the Dolomites?
Well, you can take a daytime train to Munich, stay overnight, and then head south through the Brenner Pass into the Dolomites the following day. That's the first route that comes to mind. And that's ideal if you prefer hotels and daytime trains to sleepers. And there's some lovely scenery through the Brenner Pass down to places like Bolzano.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll be taking that route next month, I think. But again, we'll come to that European sleeper service because it's a night train and that's a really interesting topic. What about Austria? If you were recommending someone to travel by train to Austria, I've been to the Tyrol in Austria via Zurich. So I went to Paris, took the train to Zurich and then connecting train around. I think Innsbruck is probably a bit further across. Would you recommend that route via Munich again, perhaps?
Well, actually, if you're going to Innsbruck, the nicest route is to take Eurostar to Paris, a TGV Lyria from Paris to Zurich, which only takes 4 hours, just over 4 hours, and then go through the Arlberg Pass on the Austrian railjet trains, which head every couple of hours from Zurich through the Arlberg into the Tyrol and through to Innsbruck. If you're going further east, of course, to Salzburg or Linz or Vienna, there are direct sleeper train 3 times a week from Brussels. So Eurostar to Brussels, an easy same station connection and an overnight sleeper straight to the eastern half of Austria.
We'll need to move on to that sleeper section soon because it keeps being mentioned. What about, though, I don't want to ask you about one other ski destination. And, you know, someone asked me this recently. I would love to ski in Norway. You know, currently I'm not planning to fly anywhere. Can you get to Norway by train?
You certainly can. I mean, it is incredibly sad that there are no ferries from the UK to Norway. The last one sailed in 2008. I never thought when I was younger that we'd see a world with no ferries between the UK and Scandinavia. How do we get here? But you can certainly get there by train. You can get from London to Hamburg by Eurostar and onwards German train, stay overnight, and then you can get from Hamburg to Oslo in Norway the following day. Via Copenhagen and Gothenburg. There's other ways you can cut it. You can stay overnight in different places as well. There is also a really nice overnight ferry from Copenhagen to Oslo, which you can build into your itinerary. Lovely ensuite cabins, restaurants, bars. That's a lovely trip. You wake up to the Oslo fjord, superb scenery. So it's worth going up on deck after breakfast.
Wow. Okay, excellent. I'm going to come back to the potential costs of that sort of thing, you know, at some point as well. But one more ski destination, Scotland. They've actually got a good amount of snow up there at the moment. I've seen people have been skiing in the last few days. And you said you were up on the Caledonian Slope. You just spent a couple of days in Scotland. You've described it as the best train in the UK.
The London Fort William Caledonian Sleeper, yes, it's the train they call the Deerstalker, the train that almost disappeared back in the 1990s. It was saved, and now, well, a mode of transportation that gets you overnight from the big smoke, London and the southeast, where I live and work, right to the heart of the West Highlands. A little travelling hotel with club car and private rooms, some with ensuite shower and toilet. In fact, there are some rooms with double beds as well. And then, of course, you wake up to deer bounding away from the train that lives up to its name, the Deerstalker, and all that fabulous West Highland scenery, the Tyndrum Horseshoe Curve, the Rannoch Moor, Carew, the most remote station in Britain, Loch Trigg, Monessi Gorge, and then into Fort William.
Beautiful. I went up in February of last year to Edinburgh, actually, and then we went on from there. And I talk about Edinburgh again. While I was having a little look around, we were talking about, you know, the time that train travel takes, and I'm going to put a link to this in the show notes. But there was a really interesting piece where you and Simon Calder from The Independent had a competition where he was flying, I believe, and you were taking the train to go to Edinburgh to see who would get there first.
That's right. I was using the new, what was then the inaugural Lumo departure. Lumo is a low-cost train operator that is trying to tackle air travel on price head on. So low fares, London to Edinburgh, they've got about 5 services a day now. And the result of Simon going by air and me going by rail, it was a draw. We both turned up at Edinburgh in the Waverley, in the centre of Edinburgh, at about the same time.
I love that. Actually, Lumo I used on the way back from Scotland. I did the sleeper train on the way up and Lumo on the way back. And you know, just like a regular train, it was an excellent value for money. Right, let's come on to night trains then, because, you know, we've referenced them, you know, several times. You know, I think we saw a period where night trains were, you know, phased out. There used to be a lot more of them all over Europe. I did Interrail back in 1987, and I use them a lot because it's a very cost-effective way of getting around Europe. But I think they were always popular, but they weren't necessarily economically viable because you need a special rolling stock. You know, typically they only do one journey per day. They don't pick people up along the way. But am I right in thinking that we are now seeing across Europe many more night services coming back?
We're seeing something of a resurgence. I mean, it's amazing just how common they used to be before the days of budget airlines. It was the budget airlines that really put the kibosh on them. They are the most difficult type of train service to run successfully in a commercial sense, but it can be done. And we have new operators like European Sleeper, startups. We also have Austrian Railways who believe in night trains, picked up the mantle from Deutsche Bahn that was about to pull the plug on their night trains, and OBE Bay, Austrian Railways night jet network, is now the biggest network of night trains in Europe. So from a UK perspective, we have European Sleeper linking Brussels with Berlin and Prague every night. We have Nightjet linking Brussels with Linz and Salzburg and Vienna three times a week, and with Berlin three times a week. And we have sleeper trains from Paris to Nice and Cannes in the south of France, and to La Tour de Carole on the border with Spain as well.
From a ski point of view, you know, a number of those are definitely pertinent. There is a SNCF service that takes you to Briançon, which links really well for Serre Chevalier. And then in the Pyrenees, you can go to, I think Tarbes might be the final destination. And notionally, you could go to Nice as well in the south. There is a ski resort near there called Isla 2000. So those are possible. The night jet is something that we've recommended and we've talked about on the ski podcast before that Austria run. You know, typically, if you're coming from the UK, you would go to Amsterdam to board that to go to Innsbruck, I think. Is that right?
Innsbruck, yes. Yes. Unfortunately, the Brussels sleeper doesn't have a portion for Innsbruck, only for Salzburg and Vienna. But it's easy to get to Amsterdam. Now, there are direct Eurostars. So catch a late morning Eurostar to Amsterdam, have a few hours in the Dutch capital, what's not to like? And then there is a daily sleeper train leaving Amsterdam at about 7 o'clock in the evening, right through to Innsbruck, arriving about 9 the following morning.
Yeah, fantastic service that, and that stops in a lot of places along the way as well, not just Innsbruck, but other access points for ski resorts. And you mentioned European Sleeper. I've previously covered European Sleeper on the podcast, and I mentioned that they have a new service that is actually going to be going through to Venice starting next month. But the exciting thing about that is it will pass through Innsbruck and then go over the Brenner Pass as you through the Brenner Pass, as you mentioned before, and going into the Italian Dolomites, coming down through to Bolzano and I think maybe Verona on the way to Venice. And that opens up a lot of Austria also on a night service, but the Dolomites make it more accessible as well. And that is a really interesting project because a lot of people might think, oh, this is some finance company funded type of thing, but it really is a bunch of a couple of founders who are very passionate about the ski industry, who've done everything from a crowdfunding point of view.
That's right. It's two Dutch Belgian entrepreneurs, former railway people who know and love night trains, who decided to start their own, and they've been running for a little while now successfully the Brussels, Amsterdam, Berlin, Prague. And this year, they're starting up a sort of trial. It's only about five or six departures, but it'll run from Brussels through the Netherlands to pick up, overnight to Munich, and then Innsbruck, and then through the Brenner Pass, Bolzano, Verona, and Venice. And I'm pleased to say I should be on the inaugural train to see how it goes on the 5th of February.
That, Mark, is very exciting because I think I'm on that one as well. I'll have to check my calendar here, but I'm going on it twice, yeah, on the 5th. Okay, cool. We'll get to meet each other face-to-face. And then later on in March, I'm going to go out with my wife. We're going to Val Gardena in the Italian Dolomites. So I'll definitely be testing it. And as it goes later on this year, we have a trip planned where we're planning to get one of their, I think, week-long passes, like a sort of mini Interrail, and stop in Amsterdam and Berlin on the same trip. So, you know, listener, if you're interested in going out to, you know, Italy or Austria, that's another one to try. There are a couple of other sort of boutique operators, you might call them, operating around Europe as well. Someone who I've covered before, I have no idea if the pronunciation is correct. They might be called Snalltaget.
Yeah, something like that. My pronunciation isn't good either. They operate a night train from Berlin and Hamburg to Stockholm. And in fact, there is another night train run by Swedish Railways, SJ, from Berlin and Hamburg to Stockholm. So you know night trains for some years and then two turn up at once. So, yeah, something of a resurgence going on here.
Right, interesting. And I think with Snalltaget as well, they also do maybe something equivalent to the Eurostar Snow Train, in that they run a train out to Zell am See in the Austrian Alps as well.
That's right, a seasonal winter train all the way from, does it start at Malmo or Stockholm? I can't remember offhand, but it does go all the way down to Austria. That's a very long journey, but it's all on one train. So that makes it very convenient.
I think most people are aware that Greta Thunberg is from Sweden, and maybe that the Flygskam movement, you know, started around there. But let's just move on then to costs. You mentioned before about understanding necessarily what the real cost is of train travel, excluding the carbon cost side of things. You know, air travel is subsidised in many ways, train travel isn't. But if you were wanting to give advice to people interested in travelling by train, what is the best way for people to kind of keep the cost down?
Well, first of all, long distance train travel has taken the leaf out of the airlines book, and it's now got dynamic yield managed pricing, the same as airlines. So if you turn up at the station and want a ticket from London to Vienna, it will cost a lot, the same as turning up at the airport on the day and trying to buy a ticket. So book in advance. Train booking opens, it depends on the operator, but it might be 4 months or 6 months ahead, not as long as air travel, but that sort of means you can keep your options open for longer. The same rules apply as booking flights. Midweek is always cheaper than Fridays or Sundays. February is possibly, except for skiing actually, but February and November are cheaper than July and August and May. Middle of the day is often cheaper than in the morning or the evening. You don't have to always combine a Eurostar departure that connects with the train you want onwards. By all means, spend some time in Paris or Brussels, because you might find a cheaper Eurostar earlier in the day or later in the day or whenever it is. And you can combine that with the cheapest onward train. You don't have to book them connecting directly. Spend some time on the way.
All of those points are extremely valid. And I think that's one of the advantages of your website, 61.com, is that you can research into that. Last year, my wife and I went out to Chamonix, and it just worked out that we ended up having lunch in Paris. It was a very relaxed time before we, you know, instead of rushing straight through from Gare du Nord to Gare de Lyon, took our time and enjoyed a bit of Paris along the way. And indeed, this isn't relating to ski, but we went out to Corsica last summer as a family. And, you know, as part of that trip, we had dinner in Paris. We had breakfast in Toulon. It was so enjoyable combining all of these different elements. I've got a question cropped up in my mind when we were discussing Norway. When do you think Interrail, buying an Interrail pass, whereby you can use several days of travel within a period of time, become better value than separate point-to-point tickets?
Well, your starting assumption is that if you're just going from A to B and back to A and you're booking in advance, then normal tickets are advanced purchase tickets, that is, are normally cheaper. But if you need to go at short notice, or if you need flexibility, or if you're doing a really complex itinerary where if you booked it with loads and loads and loads of advanced purchase tickets, no refunds, no changes, if anything happened, the whole thing would collapse like a pack of cards, then you need to consider an Interrail pass. It's almost like a backstop, actually, on an A to B and back to A journey, because if the normal prices do reach a certain level, then remembering that a cheapest 4-day Interrail pass is about €260, something like that, and it's €30 each way to use Eurostar with the pass, that's the sort of backstop. So once you get to those sort of price levels, an Interrail pass is worth considering, it's worth doing the sums.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting for sure. I am going to be using two Interrail passes this year, so I'll be reporting back about that as well. What about one of the real frustrations that people often say to me? You know, you can book Eurostar quite a long time in advance, but you can only book that European leg typically 3 months in advance. I mean, the windows are a bit arcane as to when they appear and when, you know, what is the reason for that?
Well, the reason's simple. Back in the old days, people bought tickets on the day. And these days, if you're making a typical train journey, think about it. When do you go to the supermarket in January for bread and milk you want to consume in August? No. Do you put fuel in your car at a petrol station for a journey in January that you're going to be driving in August? No, you don't. You don't plan those things ahead. And for the average train journey, I mean, me going into London, 40 miles, going a couple of hundred miles on an intercity train, I book those days or weeks ahead. And the locals in these countries, in France and Belgium and Netherlands and Austria, they too book their train journeys days or weeks ahead, not months and months. It's not a flight to Australia. So that's where the railways are coming from. Many of them have progressively extended the journey time. Eurostar know they're competing head-to-head with airlines, so they've made a real effort and extended it to up to 11 months. The Germans have now extended to 6 months. The French are still on 4 months. And then you get to people like the Moldovans, where it's still 30 days.
Right, okay. I don't know how many people listening to this podcast will be planning to travel in Moldova, but
I don't know what the skiing's like, though.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I've got a couple of closing questions. I mean, it's been really, really interesting, you know, talking about all of this, Mark. But I've got a specific one. It's really just for me, not necessarily for other listeners. But I'm going to Sicily in February. The plan is to ski on Mount Etna while we're there, which is an article I'm going to be writing up for someone. And I'm really excited about it because there is this, I don't know if it's unique, but a train ferry setup that gets you across from the mainland to Sicily. Is it unique and how does it work?
It is pretty unique now. There used to be train ferries in Scandinavia. The Hamburg-Copenhagen trains used to go over on a train ferry. They now take the long way round over a fixed link. So the only train ferry left in Europe, and probably the only train ferry left in the world. It's always difficult saying things like that because there's always something strange going on somewhere. But the only train ferry left in Europe is the one to Sicily. And people are amazed when I tell them that there are sleeper trains and daytime trains from Rome and Naples to Palermo and Catania and Syracuse. And indeed, there's a sleeper train from Milan to Palermo and Catania and Syracuse. And they're all shunted onto a ferry for the 30-minute crossing of the Straits of Messina across to Sicily from the mainland. And it's an incredible experience. You can remain on board on the train or you can go up on deck for some sea air. Just remember to return to your railway carriage in good time for when it gets shunted off at the other end.
Okay, well, I'm really looking forward to that. You know, I'm very excited about it. And as you go, I mean, hopefully, if we talk about inspiring people, I will be able to report back and say this worked really well. I've worked out my schedule. I'm going to go to Rome on day one, so you can get all the way to Rome in a day by train. I plan to go for a run in Rome the following morning and then catch that train down from Rome to Sicily going on that ferry. So we'll see how that goes. Here's another journey. This is, again, nothing to do with skiing, but it's been in the news recently. Will it be, or is it indeed possible to travel by train from Portugal to Singapore?
Where do we start? Yes. Well, this all started when they opened the Laos-China Railway linking Kunming in southern China with Vientiane in Laos, which is, of course, linked to Bangkok, which is linked by rail to Singapore. And some bright spark said, hey, the longest rail journey in the world is now Portugal to Singapore. Now, he might have mentioned that there's a little thing called a war going on between Ukraine and Russia. All travel to Russia is inadvisable. In fact, for the first time in my lifetime, all trains to Moscow from the rest of Europe are suspended. There are none. The Trans-Siberian trains, I've taken both of them, Moscow-Beijing, Moscow-Vladivostok. Well, Moscow-Vladivostok is running because it's domestic. Moscow-Beijing, there are two trains. Both have been suspended since 2019. So not really possible, certainly not advisable at the moment. And then, of course, there is the question of where you start in Portugal for it to be the longest train journey, which is it's a definition fraught with philosophical issues here. You'll often see Lagos mentioned, but actually I reckon it's Vila Real de San Antonio. And if you think that that's further east, so it's closer to Singapore, so somehow doesn't count. If you look at the direct distance, Sintra to Singapore is further. So Lagos to Singapore is also disallowed by exactly the same logic. So maybe Sintra to Singapore is the world's longest train journey. My advice is forget Portugal. Just go from your local station. If it becomes possible once again, that will be amazing enough.
Yeah, I know you've answered that question before because maybe the last person to ask you was Kay Burley on Sky News and now it's Ian Martin on the Ski Podcast. So finally then, I wonder if you were going to offer any kind of single tip apart from booking seat 61 on the first class on Eurostar to someone thinking about train travel. What would that be?
Take the plunge. Because what I find is, once people realize what's possible and do it the first time, even though it takes more effort to research and book, they love it and they want to do more of it. That's the thing. Just take the plunge the first time.
Yeah, well, that is excellent advice, Mark. I would like to thank you for that. I'm actually just going to finish off with a quote again that I found, a quote of yours, which I found, which says, I thought it was very beautiful. Collectively, we are racing through spectacular landscapes, covering a mile every 40 seconds, using Victorian infrastructure to the full and causing minimal environment and harm. The rail traveller is in touch with the world. And I think that was specifically about your journey up to Scotland. But the rail traveller is in touch with the world. I think if we want to kind of sign off with any kind of message here, that would be a really good one to have. So thank you so much, Mark, for sharing your time with us today. I really appreciate it. And hopefully I'll get to meet you next month.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Well, that was really interesting speaking with Mark there. Now, I enjoy all feedback about the show, so why don't you let me know what you thought about that interview? Please do contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. We've had a little bit of feedback since the last episode. Dan Trapp on LinkedIn, he said, keep up the great work and have a great season. And Alex Neville very kindly bought me a coffee and said, love this podcast, always gets me in the mood for the ski season. Now, there are now 245 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and a whopping 202 of those were listened to in the last week. There is so much to listen to in our back catalogue. Just go to theskipodcast.com and have a look around. You are bound to find something that sparks your interest. And if you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. Follow us. Just look for that button and press it now. Give us a review or just leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I respond to all comments. And book your ski hire with InSport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST or simply take the link in the show notes, because that will help us. Now, you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at The Ski Podcast. But for now, I'd like to thank Mark for joining me today. And finally, listener, thank you for sharing this time with us. And until next time, goodbye.